Welcome to the Culture and Sports Podcast, where we have discussions about how leadership and organizational culture impact organizational success, team and athlete performance, and the short and long-term mental, physical, and emotional health of athletes. The Culture and Sports Podcast is brought to you by Culture and Sports. Culture and Sports helps sports organizations, teams, coaches, support and front office staff, and athletes understand the importance of leadership and organizational culture and its direct impact to success.
Please join Robert Boland and Dr. Jeremy Piasecki in this season of the Culture and Sports Podcast.
Welcome back to the Culture and Sports Podcast. I have an extraordinary guest for you today, Mark Edelman. He's the professor of law and director of sports business ethics at Brew College. Mark, why don't you introduce yourself?
It's a pleasure to meet you, Jeremy, and I'm delighted to be on the broadcast. A little bit about me. I am trained as a practicing attorney. I practiced sports and antitrust law first at Skadden Arps, which is one of the largest law firms in the country, and then at Dewey Ballantyne, where I work with Jeffrey Kessler on Players Association side work. For the past 15 years, I've been a professor of law, and a lot of my focus has been on the college sports industry. From an antitrust perspective, from a legal perspective, but also from an ethical perspective. And I look at college sports as being a part of higher education. And my research looks at how these higher educational institutions are continuously behaving in manners that go against the law and even go against their views of morality. So I'm delighted to talk to you more about that or any other topic that interests you today, Jeremy.
No, thank you so much. I really do appreciate it. I guess the first question I wanted to ask you is, during our annual leadership summit that we recently had, there was a few talk in a few of the panels about the term student athlete. What are your thoughts about the term student athlete?
Well, as words themselves, and if you look at them purely based upon words, the individuals that play for these schools, are enrolled in classes, which technically makes them students, and they compete in the sport, which technically makes them athletes. And if we look purely at a dictionary vernacular, there is nothing wrong. The problem with the term is not from the pure dictionary definition, but rather why the term was coined and how it's been used. Right around the year 1953, in the early years of Walter Byers serving as president of the NCAA, there was a court case that found that a college athlete who was injured was entitled to workman's compensation. And the NCAA member schools did not like the fact that this athlete was deemed to be a worker. So they decided to engage in a behavior known as regulatory categorization. Regulatory categorization means that you're making up a new term for something with the goal of trying to get preferential legal treatment. Wanting to create this fiction that the worker is not a worker and thus isn't entitled workers' compensation. Walter Byers, as leader of the NCAA, came up with this term student-athlete. And the purpose of the term was to try to differentiate these individuals from being workers, to treat them in a status that would be inferiorly under employment law. So again, I mean, in a vacuum, there's nothing wrong with saying that these individuals are both students and athletes. But like so many other terms that have come to be disfavored today, this was a term that was meant to reduce the legal status of these individuals by changing the way they were perceived. And I've stopped using the term student athlete and have gone to college athlete, not because the term itself is that problematic, but the history of the term, the way it's been used, and the goal of the NCAA in using that term makes it very harsh for the athlete itself.
No, thank you so much for sharing that, Mark. I do have a cool question for you regarding socialization of the term. So back in the 1950s, the NCAA started socializing the term so it became, the go-to term for everyone, not only within colleges and universities, but also within the law sphere, right? Is the NCAA still using that term today, or trying to continue to socialize it, that is the correct term, or have they changed their course?
No, the NCAA is very much using that term today. Interestingly, the National Labor Relations Board had an opinion not that long ago which indicated that the use of the term student-athlete in itself might be an unfair labor practice by a member school because of the intent in that is, according to the NLRB, it was being used in a way to make the college athletes believe that they were something less than employees and thus could not try to assert employee rights. So there have been indicators coming out of the National Labor Relations Board saying that schools in the NCAA should not be using that term because of the misleading implications that have emerged from it over the past 60 years. The irony, or perhaps the unfortunateness, is NCAA member schools and the institution itself seem to have doubled down. Since the NLRB came back and questioned the use of the term, it seems as if the NCAA is using it more than ever before. If you look at the NCAA public relations releases, everything is student-athlete. If you look at their briefs to the courts, everything is student-athlete. It's almost once they were told that you can't use this term to try to lead the athletes to believe a legal fiction that they're something less than employees, the response hasn't been, let's walk away from the term and say college athlete. The response has been, yeah, try to make us stop it. We're going to use it some more.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts on that. Now, let's talk a little bit about, ethics ramifications of the NCAA continuing to try to call the athletes, college athletes, student athletes, unions and people that are trying, or athletes are trying to come together to become bargaining units, or colleges or universities, all trying to use different terms and different reasonings behind it. Can you talk a little bit more about the ethics of it? And you don't have to necessarily stick with one side of the ethics, like where the ethics lie and how it impacts athletes or colleges or university. You can talk about generalized ethics overall.
Legally speaking, an individual is an employee if they operate for a benefit of an institution and under their control. As far as the Region 13 decision in the National Labor Relations Board with respect to Northwestern University football players' desire to unionize, Region 13 had recognized that these football players, at least those that received grants and aid, constituted employees. And at least some college athletes clearly meet the traditional definition of employee. At least at the revenue-generating programs, the primary role of these athletes is to make revenue for the institution, not to play a sport for hobby. And extreme control is exercised over these individuals by the school, by their conference, and arguably even the NCAA, down to what clothing they wear when they're not playing in games, what cars they drive, access to their social media, times they have to be at practice, classes they're required to take that other students are not required to take, classes they're prohibited from taking that other students are able to take at the school, and the like. From an ethical perspective here, we have a dichotomy that is incredibly bothersome. In many colleges throughout the country, a progressive education is offered to students that generally stands for principles such as respecting employees and employee rights. Whether it be a law class, an ethics class, a sociology class, you can find classes throughout the books, throughout the country, that talk about ethical treatment about workers, that frown upon things like sweatshop work, frown upon the notion of paying minimum wage, much less than minimum wage, that talk about the ethical imperative of doing more than the moral minimum. That is standard throughout many, if not most, colleges throughout the country. But there is a disconnect between what many colleges teach in the classroom to their students when discussing other industries and the business practices that they choose to adopt for themselves when operating big-time commercial sports. The same universities that do not hesitate to teach about the importance of protecting employee rights and employee benefits maintain a system where they try to keep workers who make large revenues for them in certain sports like D1 football and men's basketball as somewhat less than employees. They don't even want to give them minimum wage. The same schools throughout the country that teach courses on the importance of unionization and worker organization are fighting tooth and nail to prevent their own college athletes in revenue-generating sports from organizing for purposes of bargaining against them. The same schools that talk about the importance of self-actualization of the individual and self-actualization of the historically disempowered say that college athletes are not entitled to a voice. The same schools that offer courses and have presidents speaking regularly on this notion of DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion in their college sports programs continue to turn and profit off historically black and historically low-income labor. And if you look at the ratio of college athletes on football, men's and women's basketball teams that are black as compared to the rest of the student body, there's an extreme disconnect. And when you talk about schools saying that we need to use free football labor to be able to subsidize sports such as squash and fencing, what they're really saying is we need to use free, predominantly low-income, disproportionately black labor to fund sports that primarily are only used on the country club ranks. So everything that these NCAA member schools are doing in their lobbying to maintain a particular system of college sports goes against what they teach in the classrooms as being ethical business practices about looking at stakeholder ethics, about looking at historically disempowered groups, and being cognizant of issues of diversity, equity, and inclusion.
No, thank you so much for sharing that, Mark. You highlighted how many people and how many courses, how many presidents of colleges and universities are talking about all these great initiatives. Now, for colleges and universities that could afford to pay minimum wage, we understand that the argument is that they don't want to pay minimum wage, right? Because, you know, they're somehow, you know, ethically or values based against it because, oh, this is just a hobby for the athletes. It's something for them to do in addition to their college experience. But if all of these goals were to be realized by, you know, all levels of, you know, collegiate sports, what about the historically low income and black universities that don't have a lot of financial support? How would they be able to afford this? And what would be the way forward for schools like that?
Well, first, my position has not been that all college athletes constitute employees. The definition of an employee is someone who's performing a benefit, typically looked at in terms of revenue, for an employer under a test of control. Now, Professors John Holden, Michael McCann, and I have a law review article that recently came out in Illinois Law Review. And in this article, the collegiate employee athlete, we look at the test that we believe would be appropriate and we apply it to college athletes. So just to be very clear, most college athletes at most schools are not employees. If you're not generating revenue, well, then the sport exists for the benefit, for the physical education, the physical enjoyment of the people who are participating in it. And we're not talking about what we're seeing primarily at Division II and Division III levels. We're not talking about sports that are not televised for people to watch, sports that are not charging gate admission. So when people say, well, they all are, I think you have one of two things going on. One is it's an overly litigious view of what's an employee that fails to meet reality. Or second, it's a fiction of a slippery slope to try to address the very real issue. The very real issue is you have a limited number of sports, depending on school, anywhere between 3 and maybe 5 or 6 sports, at a limited number of schools, maybe about 150 schools, where the purpose of athletics is to generate revenue for those schools. For example, if you look at Ohio State University, Ohio State University brought in more than $250 million last year from its athletic program. And more than $150 million of that came specifically from football. To put things in perspective, more revenue came from Ohio State football, whatever it would be, 12-game season last year, than the comparable professional team in Columbus, the Blue Jackets in the NHL, made over the course of an 81-game season. I don't think there is a good faith argument out there that there is not money to pay something to the football players at Ohio State University. Now, as far as where the money is going to come from, it's another case where people who are opposed to doing the morally right thing and even the legally obligated thing try to tie together two things to indicate a problem where there doesn't need to be one. Now, the NCAA is composed of over 1,000 member schools, and it's a bottom-up trade association, meaning that every rule they have is voted upon by each of the individual member schools. Now, if you ask who does the voting, it's typically the college president or the athletic director. Now, as long as the NCAA maintains a rule in place that says no member school may pay its college athletes, what in essence that does is that ensures every single school that should be competing against each other, not only on the field, but also in the business sense, to have the best product. It's an agreement amongst each of them that they will maintain a revenue split 100% to non-athletes, 100% to non-athletes, 0% to athletes. The question then happens, what happens when you have 100-0 revenue sharing? Where does that money go? Now, if colleges were for-profit institutions and they reached this agreement with one another, we know that it would lead to additional money for the shareholders of the businesses. Now, with the NCAA member schools being non-for-profits, the money has to go somewhere. Now, some of that money probably goes to other parts of sports, but the reality is a lot of that money stays in the system. If you look at the salaries of the people that vote themselves, the coaches, athletic directors, administrators, many of them are paid many millions of dollars. And the question is, where does the money come to pay these individuals? Well, as long as you have an agreement not to compensate the college athletes, and the money needs to stay in the system, well, then those very individuals who vote for these policies, the presidents and athletic directors and coaches and administrators, they're paid more than would otherwise be their free market wage. They keep a piece of what otherwise would be going to the college athletes. They become quasi-shareholders in a non-shareholder system. Now, if you're not sure that's actually the case, we could compare some of the compensation that goes to college coaches and athletic directors to their counterparts in similar professional sports where they have coaches and they have general managers. It is noteworthy that we have head football coaches in college football who are now making $10, $11, $12 million per year, which is as much, if not more, than counterparts in the NFL. We have assistant coaches that are making several million dollars per year. At the University of Michigan, their quarterback coach is paid over $1 million per year. Now, if you want to imagine a hierarchy chart, an org chart of the University of Michigan, this is that quarterback coach. You have the head coach. Below the head coach, you have the offensive coordinator and the defensive coordinator. The quarterback coach doesn't even report to the head coach. The quarterback coach reports to the offensive coordinator. This is three steps down that hierarchy chart, and there's over $1 million per year for that individual. There are places where athletic trainers are making $500,000 or more per year. You have administrators like conference commissioners that are bringing home $5 million per year. Now, part of why these humongous salaries are out there is because we've quashed the free market for player compensation. Again, I am a believer that the capitalist system generally works. I'm a believer in free markets, and I have no problem with what any coach or athletic director is able to earn on the free market. But this isn't a free market. This is 1,000 member colleges that come together that restrain trade in the labor market for college athletes by reaching an agreement to ban any member school that wants to give more than nothing or more than the cost of attendance to the college athlete. And the result of this restraint of trade is by limiting the amount that's available to one group in a pool where there are revenues that don't go to shareholders, it's a different group that gets it. And I don't think it's a complete accident that the people that vote on the NCAA policies, who vote to maintain the system that have historically denied college athlete compensation, are also the ones who ultimately get some of the difference put in their pockets.
So, Mark, you and what you were just talking about brought up the identifier as we. And I know you're not talking about me and you. I know you're talking about we as in, collegiate sports and the NCAA. But the NCAA isn't necessarily just one organization that the athletes would theoretically belong to and that all the money goes to. There's a lot of other organizations, you know, on top of the colleges and universities. There's conferences, there's the NCAA, there's other organizations that are quasi-involved within the college sports landscape. What does we really mean in this case?
It's the collection of colleges. And let's be clear what the NCAA. The NCAA is a bottom-up trade association where policy is voted on by their members. In essence, they function as an economic cartel. Now, it doesn't matter who the president of the NCAA is. You still have the same exact member colleges at the end of the day that vote on policy. And it doesn't matter what the name of the NCAA is. If they broke into two equal-sized groups, you would still have colleges voting on policy in their own self-interest. Now, if each of the five big conferences broke together, broke away, and truly became their own thing, the member schools within each conference might continue to collude, but at least there would be an economic interest in the schools within each conference needing to compete against each other. If the NCAA disappeared, if we no longer had 1,000 schools voting to mandate everybody follow the same rules, if we ended up with groups of maybe 18 schools or 24 schools having their own mini thing,
like 100 years ago,
the member schools might still collude together. But at the end of the day, they would need to compete against the other conferences. Now, what you just said is so on point, like 100 years ago. We don't even have to go back 100 years. All we have to do is go back to 1951. Prior to 1951, The NCAA was, in essence, a very loosely held oversight organization that handled scheduling and some administrative matters. And the NCAA, just to make the point clear, the Big Ten Conference had these very nice offices. The NCAA had one part-time employee and worked out of the back room of the Big Ten's office. Now, the reason why the NCAA got transformed from just this administrative organization into the economic cartel it is today is the member colleges in the Big Ten did not have any way of constraining the behavior of member colleges in other conferences. The Big Ten member schools did not like the fact that certain schools in the Southeast were starting to increase the benefits that they were providing to college athletes to try to induce top college athletes to come to their school. And the Big Ten schools had no way of sanctioning SEC schools. So what the Big Ten member schools did was they got a lot of the schools together and convinced them to elevate the NCAA to become the economic cartel over everybody. So now that they were no longer able to, before they were not able to stop the SEC schools from competing against them on economic terms with athletes. Once the NCAA took on that larger presence as the all-encompassing economic cartel, they were able to use the threat of sanction, the threat of throwing out of the entity on these other schools, and it got everybody to play by the rules in which no college athlete would be compensated.
So we're so earlier you were talking about athlete compensation and the agreements where it's 0% athlete compensation and 100% goes to not to athletes. Is it the same representation within the conferences, the universities, and the NCAA of what the athlete's voting power is? Is it still 100% non-athlete and 0% athlete?
Athletes don't have any meaningful voice in the present process. And the NCAA does have these student councils that will put students on certain certain committees, but it's form over substance. Just to make the point crystal clear, the head of the group that's considered that they call the Student Athlete Commission at present is Cody Shimp. And they refer to Cody Shimp as being, and they use that term, student athlete. To be very clear, Cody Shimp has been a volunteer assistant baseball coach for the past couple of years. He has not even played. So first, they're picking people that are going to have economic interests at the moment that will support the cartel's interests, not the college athlete's interests. Second, the athletes are not even choosing the people involved. And third, even if we moved a step better, most college athletes and most college sports are going to be fine with the current system. If you are a swimmer or a track and field athlete and you're not bringing in any revenue, you're not going to be deemed an employee, and you're actually maybe benefiting from the system in some way because you have the football players and the men's and women's basketball players that bring in the revenue that to some extent is staying in the system. The individuals we're really concerned about here are the individuals who are chosen to attend schools primarily based upon their revenue-making capabilities as performers and workers in specific sports, where the sports bring in sums of revenue based upon selling tickets to fans, airing games on television, and selling light and using intellectual property that they've garnered from the games, and then don't share in that amount with the athletes who are providing the primary work. Now, if you believe that John Locke, who we consider one of the Enlightenment scholars, is someone who we should value what he believes, John Locke has said every man is entitled to the fruits of his labor. And I think we could take what John Locke said a few hundred years ago, and I think we can make a very subtle change to that for today's day and age, and say every man and woman is entitled to the fruits of their labor. And if the fruits of the labor of playing in football or in basketball is many millions of dollars are derived through television broadcasts which feature these individuals playing in these games, and if schools are marketing their universities based upon the brand equity that comes from these athletes playing in their games, well, these workers who put their bodies at risk to appear on a nationally televised or a regionally televised television program and who perform for many thousands of people in stadiums and arenas where there's money charged for tickets, they should be entitled to some of the benefits that derive from it. And if we don't do that, I think we have a real problem both legally, but also ethically.
Can you talk a little bit more? I know you brought it up earlier in this discussion. Will you talk a little more about ethics and also like some values-based ideas and thoughts on this, not only from you, but I'm sure you've spoken to many athletes over time, and maybe you could share, where the values and ethics are, even though those are two completely different things.
I mean, I think there are a lot of different ways that we could look at this. this. We could look at it, John Locke, that every man and woman is entitled to the fruits of their labor, and recognize that we have certain individuals who are bringing in large sums of revenue based on their work and performance, who are denied a share of the revenue. We have stakeholder theory, and stakeholder theory recognizes that in the business setting, it's not just the shareholders and maximizing shareholder value that matters. It's the other constituent pieces, and workers are a stakeholder. So from that point of view, some of the revenue should be shared with the worker purely as a stakeholder. We have values of employee autonomy and employee rights, and denying these individuals the opportunity to share in the fruits of their labor, and even setting the governance of the industry that they work in is disempowerment. We have capitalism as a form of ethics as well, and I think sometimes we deny the reality that Adam Smith we consider a worldly philosopher. Adam Smith wasn't purely an economist. He was focused on social issues, he was focused on philosophy. And in Wealth of Nations, when Adam Smith supports capitalism, he talks about capitalism creating the best product for the lowest price for consumers. And if you believe that capitalism works because individual businesses compete against one another to create the best product, to get the best labor. If you believe in capitalism has one rule to it to make the entire system work. Capitalism works only as long as the competitors in the market space are doing just that, competing to create the best product for consumers. And collusion, when companies come together to restrain trade, when you create cartels, that's the antithesis of capitalism because you no longer have competition. So when you look at the behavior by the NCAA member schools, each of these institutions that operate in a capitalist world, well, they compete against each other in most attributes. I have no doubt that Cal and Stanford compete vigorously to recruit students. I have no doubt that the University of Michigan and the University of Wisconsin compete in the free markets to hire the best professors in various disciplines. But these 1,000 member schools come together, and instead of competing against each other to hire the best workers for their commercial and revenue-generating sports programs, they've reached an agreement with one another that they will not compete, and they'll only pay the worker whatever they agree at the time, whether it be zero or saying a little less than cost of attendance, or cost of attendance, or if the house settlement comes through, some amount, but not more in aggregate than $22 million. But whatever it is, they are going against the free market. They are going against those principles. And to make it even worse, it's not that they're going against the free market because there's some social value that they think transcends it. They're going against the free market and colluding in restraint of trade. They're maintaining a college sports cartel. Because it makes each of these executives more money. They are going against the capitalist system here, which is the ethical system that's in place, because they realize that by violating the rules of capitalism, they will make even more money.
That's a problem. No, that's very powerful, everything you just said. You know, a cartel-based system, price fixing, you know, collusion, you know, those are all things that if someone was doing that against the NCAA or its member schools, the first place they would be is in the courtroom, right? Like, that would be the first place they would be.
For one moment, I think the law is crystal clear, and that's why they keep on losing antitrust cases. The NCAA keeps on losing their antitrust cases because they keep on combining and conspiring in the restraint of trade. And it's pretty obvious. They lost 9-0 in the Alston case because all 9 judges, no matter if you were appointed by Trump or appointed by Obama or appointed by anybody in between, recognize that this is illegal conduct in restraint of trade. But let me go even beyond the law, because I think the law is pretty transparent. Because the NCAA is now seeking an exemption from Congress so they don't have to follow certain antitrust laws and certain labor laws. Imagine that I, as a professor, get in front of a class and start advocating for creating economic cartels. Imagine that me as a professor start teaching that when businesses don't want to comply with antitrust or labor law, they should get together and use their power and lobby Congress to not to follow the law that might makes right. Imagine that me as a professor argue that we should try to come up with new names for things for purpose of regulatory categorization so we don't have to give basic rights to our workers to make them seen as something less than employees. Imagine me as a professor defending a work situation where you have historically low income and disproportionately black individuals putting their bodies on the line each week to make my business more money. They're not tenuring me. They're probably throwing me out of the class. I am not going to have much of a career in academia if these are the things that I advocate for. And those same individuals, when they're not talking about what we should teach in class, but we look at their very behaviors, what are these member colleges doing? They are colluding in restraint to trade to make themselves more money. They are going to Congress and collectively lobbying to try to convince Congress to not make them follow antitrust law and labor law. They are using historically low-income black and minority workers to provide an activity, a form of entertainment that we enjoy, that they keep the profits off of, not the worker. And yet somehow, when they do it, it's different to them than if any other collection of businesses in the world got together and did the exact same thing. I'm very comfortable with antitrust law the way it is. I'm very comfortable with labor law the way it is. I'm very comfortable with principles that say we don't exploit classes of people, and if people are doing work product, they should have a voice in the outcome. But that's got to apply across the board. You can't have one system for every business out there and a different business and a different set of rules when higher education decides to do sports. That is a bias.
One of the terms you brought up earlier was stakeholder. At Culture and Sports, we talk all the time about stakeholders, why they're incredibly important. And you'd be amazed how much pushback we get whenever we write or talk about athletes being stakeholders. They are stakeholders of the team. They are an equal member of the organization. They just serve a different role as the coach or the athletic director or the GM or the support staff. They have their own specific role, but they're still an equal stakeholder. You know, whether we write about it, talk about it, you know, have it in our curriculum and courses, there's always pushback. Why do you think that is, that you know, advocating, you know, or just saying, yes, athletes are stakeholders in this, and let's find the best solution possible. Why is there such, you know, a huge pushback? And it's not necessarily monetary. Do you think it's more of a power ego thing within that cartel? Why do you think making athletes equal stakeholders is so difficult?
You know, it's interesting. As you ask the question, I think back to my freshman year of college at the University of Pennsylvania, where I studied business at Wharton. And by the time I got there, Wharton started doing a lot more in ethics, which I think was a good thing. And I took a legal studies and ethics class as a freshman with a professor, Alan Strudler. And one of the things we had to debate was whether, as a matter of business imperative, whether the goal of every business is to maximize shareholder value or whether the interest of other stakeholders should be considered. And it's an interesting question of what purpose a business serves. You know, several years later, after I graduated, I was working for a consulting company, and the same issue came up. Whether or not the executives of a company have the obligation to maximize their shareholder values, or are they allowed to consider other interests as well? like the environment for their people. Stakeholder ethics is such a controversial topic in the generality, because especially where you have a publicly held company, the question comes into play typically about, are you supposed to be devoted entirely to your shareholders? And where could you consider these other folks? Because I think we would understand if you have a business with many shareholders and the CEO says, okay, we're going to give all the money to the workers, the shareholders are not going to get what they expect. Now, the controversy here in college sports is not one that falls under the general and very real controversy between shareholder maximization of profits and stakeholder ethics. We're dealing with university systems that are nonprofits. They're either public or private, but they're nonprofits. So we don't have shareholders that lose out if you give these other stakeholders something, if you recognize the college athletes as having some rights. And giving them a voice is not going to take away from the reasonable expectations of owners at the end of the day. So I think the rationale is different from the general conversation of whether there's an obligation for a company to maximize shareholder value. I think there's an implicit part of this of jealousy, the belief that these people are young, and not liking the idea of young people being able to earn a lot of money because they have a particular skill. I mean, we see pushback sometimes when you see professional athletes' salaries published, or singers or entertainers or actors, this dislike for someone who's younger than we are, but has a skill and is able to monetize it. There's a sense of, well, we should do things this way because we've always done things this way. You know, some things have always been done a particular way because they work well. There are many things that have been ingrained in our society that are wrong. And even if you look at something like college sports, it has changed a lot over time. If you go back and you look at the year 1906, in 1906, we had the wedge play where we literally lifted up the running back and threw them over the offensive line, sometimes breaking their necks. We had the hurdle play. We had the we had these flying plays where all the players would grab hands and people would get seriously injured. Things change in time. All because a system historically worked one way doesn't mean that there aren't modifications or reform needed. And again, that's what's taught in the classroom and every other setting. It's just this holier-than-thou notion. You have college presidents come out and say, we're different because we want to be different, because they want better. And I've got one more for you, Jeremy. If we talk about cartels, if we talk about trade association cartels that say we shouldn't have to follow the law because we're different, you know, higher education is not the first industry to claim that they should be treated differently under the law. The Sherman Act, Section 1 of the Sherman Act, every contract, combination, or conspiracy in the restraint of trade shall be declared to be illegal, was passed in 1890. Some of our first antitrust decisions at the turn of the century involved the oil industry. And guess what the oil industry said? We should be treated differently. You had the large railroads. The railroads said, we have high fixed costs to build railroads. We should be treated differently. National Society of Professional Engineers, 1979. We are a learned profession. We should be treated differently. Time and time and time again, every industry that has not wanted to comply with the laws of capitalism in our country have said they should be treated differently. And time and time and time and time again, courts have said, no, you should be treated the same. And Congress has said, no, you should be treated the same. The big exception is higher education. They don't want to pay by the same rules as everybody. They want to teach you the rules. They want you to come into a class and tell students the rules. They want to tell you that this is the way that the world should work, and this is rules matter, culture matters, stakeholders matter. But if you look at the empirical behavior, you put these same leaders behind closed doors, and you put that big blue NCAA logo out, at the end of the day, they are no better than the worst that we see in big business. It's a very upsetting study to watch. We might teach one thing in the classroom, but when some of these colleges get together, and their presidents and athletic directors get to, on the side, run a big commercial sports business, They collude. They restrain trade. They deny the recognition of employees as being employees. They look to keep more for themselves. They come up with excuses why what they should do to be okay. And perhaps scarier than that, the longer I look at college sports, the more I begin to realize. These are the same people that are pushing ex-MOOCs. They're the same people that are pushing moving higher education online instead of having it in the classroom. They're the same people who are looking to find new ways of charging student activity fees. The same people who find ways to give very big raises to the people at the absolute top, while not doing anything for those below. The NCAA might be a microcosm of where the college industry is at this point in time. Now that's scary for me.
No, that's incredibly scary because, you know, history keeps on repeating itself. You know, people are exempt, right? I'm different. We're different. We're not one member institution, we're 1,000 different institutions, and we're loosely controlling this group. But meanwhile, they're talking behind closed doors and they're making all the decisions, right? So let's talk a little bit more about stakeholders before we finish. So the athletes are definitely not stakeholders in this situation at all. Would you even say that the member institutions, the colleges and universities, are even really stakeholders in this? Or do you think it's really just the conferences, the NCAA, and maybe a few really big schools that are really directing where the NCAA goes and what the decisions really are?
Not sure. I mean, it's 100% the colleges. It's only the colleges. And, you know, they like to put out labels like conferences. They like to put out labels like NCAA. They like to come up with new committees like the Knight Commission. At the end of the day, it's the same thing. Pick any member conference. You pick the one. Let's talk about the Big Ten, which is now far bigger than 10 schools. The Big Ten policies, all of them are the schools that are the members voting on the policy. It's a bottom-up association of the members. Big Ten commissioner is just an administrator that enforces what the schools say. The schools want to change their rules to compensate college athletes, they can. Look at the NCAA. You know, if you wonder why in many ways Charlie Baker's policies sound so similar to Mark Emmert's policies, and Mark Emmert's policies sound so similar to Brand before him, and Brand's policies sound so similar to Cedric Dempsey's before him, it's again the figurehead position. The 1,000 or so member schools vote on policy. You look at the Knight Commission that likes to call themselves reformers, and you want to know why the Knight Commission comes out in the same position as the schools that are making enough money to be revenue generating, but not enough money to be Ohio State or Michigan. It's because many of the voters of the Knight Commission are the presidents of the very same schools that vote there the same way they do when they vote on their athletic conferences, that vote the same way they do when they vote for the NCAA. It's a problem. I mean, sometimes we're all too quick with our speech, myself included. And sometimes I say the NCAA this or the NCAA that because it's easier to speak that way. It's shorthand. We need to be more careful. And maybe I should be at the forefront of being more careful. When we have NCAA policy, it is not one blue circular logo with a trademark on it is somehow denying college athletes a share of the fruits of their labor. It is 1,000 colleges led by 1,000 presidents with 1,000 different boards of regents or boards of trustees that vote to collectively restrain trade to the detriment of college athletes. And maybe we let these college boards of trustees and athletic directors and coaches and presidents get away with way too much because the way they behave when they give speeches to the public is very different from what they do when they could convince us it's a blue circle that's passing these rules. It's not a blue circle, and it's not Charlie Baker, and it was never Mark Emmert, It is the individuals that run these institutions.
Thank you so much for coming on the Culture and Sports Podcast, Mark. Before we go, though, I wanted to ask you if there's one thing that you could say to our viewers, listeners, the NCAA, conferences, colleges, universities, athletic directors, coaches, and athletes, what would that be?
If you believe that something is wrong, stand up for it. We have one chance in life to live it. We have one chance to build a career, do something that's meaningful. I got started in this in two ways. As a freshman at the University of Pennsylvania in 1996, I wrote an article that as a freshman I never published on college athlete compensation. And as a law student at the University of Michigan, I wrote an article that I published in 2002 called Reevaluating Amateurism Standards in College Basketball, where I argued that the NCAA's collective rules violated antitrust law and the restraints on athletes compensating endorsing products for money was illegal. I got a lot of pushback at times for what I wrote, at least initially. One of the big law firms that I worked on didn't want me working on certain matters based upon what I'd published. I had a wonderful antitrust professor, second year of law school, who I told him what I planned to write on. He just told me I was wrong, and I didn't stop. And 22 years after publishing my first student note, I've been able to build a career based on things I believe on. And it took a long time before we began to see change. But my student note was a centerpiece to the testimony I gave to California in favor of the name, image, and likeness bill in 2019. Some of my more recent law review articles were parts of why states, including New York and Ohio, have hired me to work on more recent antitrust cases against the NCAA. It's important to have people you trust. It's important to have ideas that you run by other people. But all because something you're saying at one point in time might be seen as unpopular doesn't mean it will always be that way. And if you sincerely believe that there's a system that needs to change, do your research, talk to people with different views, become an expert on your topic. But go after what you believe, because we have one shot to do that in this world.
And that's a wrap for this week's episode of the Culture and Sports Podcast. We hope that this episode has started an internal dialogue, or even one with your team, about the importance of leadership and organizational culture. If you'd like to learn more about culture and sports, the Culture and Sports Podcast, or other programs, go to cultureandsports.com, where there is a wealth of resources, articles, research, podcasts, video shows, webinars, and courses. And don't forget to connect with us on social media, on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, YouTube, and LinkedIn at Culture and Sports, and on Twitter at Culture and Sport. Thank you for tuning in to the Culture and Sports Podcast.